this is my most fun, exciting project I've had in ages. So,
welcome to Buy This Comic, the show where you keep the vital and vibrant medium of comics alive by infusing it with your hard-earned cash. I'm your host, Jason Mojica, and this week we're joined by James Romberger. Hello, James.
Hello, Jason.
And Josh Bayer. Hello, Josh.
Hi.
They're the team working on the Naked Raygun etched 7-inch record and comic project, which just launched on Kickstarter and will be released by Xylophone. We'll talk to them all about it right after this word from our sponsor.
Comics, they're not just for grown-ups anymore. Join the Hey Kids Comics Club, and every month we'll send you a new graphic novel for kids ages 6 to 10, plus a members-only zine with lots of fun stuff in it. Go to heykidscomics.net to learn more.
So the funny thing about, this sponsor is, the sponsor is me, and Xylophone is me. And so, and basically this is all one gigantic piece of propaganda from our vertically integrated media and entertainment empire to get you to back this amazing project on Kickstarter. So this is kind of like the 60 Minutes interview where they do this incredible feature on this new book that has come out that's on Simon & Schuster, which also happens to be owned by Viacom. So this is basically like a tiny DIY version of an evil corporation trying to convince you to buy our wares. So on that note, let's just talk about the origin of the project a little bit. And instead of me starting that story, why don't I go to James?
Well, you told me about this band, Naked Raygun, and your idea. Now, I'd heard of Naked Raygun. I'm sure they played New York different times. I remember seeing their name on posters and things. I hadn't actually heard the song in question, and I really liked it. It was like a kind of a quintessential punk anthem, and so I could relate to it on a direct level like that. And I like punk really. When I was a kid, it was like, I came to New York and then I saw the A7 Club, and it was really hardcore. A lot of the bands were only like 15 or something. I went in there and they were like, the energy. It's the first time I ever saw people slam dancing, and they were like just flying through the air. I was like, holy shit. So I really liked that energy and the punk energy. And this is probably the most punk comic I've ever done. In some ways, and here I am with Josh Bear, who is also a punk artist. There's not that many of us. It's like Gary Panter, and there's not so many punk artists.
Eddie Bone, he's like an OG punk artist.
Eddie Bone, yeah. So it's a small club.
A bunch of punk
depends
fans
on like sitting around working.
A bunch of new punk artists that we haven't heard about, people coming up or who are like younger than us, so they're a little bit off our radar.
So this is kind of like a passing the baton of a crazy idea. Because for me, it was, I heard that Naked Raygun was putting out his first record in 30 years. And I was like, oh, it'd be amazing to put out a weird limited edition record. And I've always been a comic guy, so I was like, what about a comic and record? Reached out to James. So you took the idea, and then you reached out to Josh. I'm trying to figure out, I'm interested in the game of telephone that has transpired here that has led to what will
I knew that Josh liked Naked Raygun because he'd done that comic Suspect Device, and that title is out of one of their songs, and I think you said it.
It's a song that Naked Raygun covered. Yeah, it's a Stiff Little Fingers song. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought of Josh immediately, and I was kind of wanted to do something with Josh for a while. Yeah. He'd gone on and off, and we worked a little bit on some stuff for his all-time comic stuff. But I like his energy. He's a very good teacher. We've taught a lot of the same kids at Parsons and this and that. So, and I like his energy, and he's a very. I like the energy of his work too. He's got a very hardcore aesthetic, but then also a certain, almost a classical line that I've seen in his stuff. And so I thought we might be simpatico visually. It's an interesting kind of thing. Well, basically I'm drawing like a bunch of stuff in a sort of a narrative, but then I'm leaving space for Josh, but then I'm also kind of trying to draw prompts out of him to do things, and then maybe I'll be working around him. So we'll see how it plays out. We're about we're not quite halfway in on the actual work of it. I'm just trying to work out the structure. We sort of got the beginning, the middle, and the end, and now we got to fill in the spaces between. I know where I want to get, where we started, and where we got to get to, but a lot of stuff in the middle is up for grabs, and it's part of an improvisational process that I can't think of anybody else that's actually worked this way before. So good, it's ours.
But yeah, can you explain that a little bit? And perhaps, I mean, it's not quite a comic jam per se, because some people might be familiar with that. And certainly people are familiar with artists teaming up. Because look, as I was trying to describe this, I also had a hard time, because like, it's not unique that to have a couple of artists working together on a project. That's part of comic history. Artists collaborate on things all the time. And then there's the comic jam, whereas, you know, kind of like you think about underground stuff, and like someone does something on a page and then someone else responds to it and they pass it around. There's 17 different people on it. And it's just kind of a weird kind of.
Well, Josh did the suspect device thing that Josh did. It is actually quite, you should talk about that, Josh. Like,
yes, the suspect device was a collage-y comics project. You know, I was the editor on it and I did some issues, and if people haven't seen it, it's hard to get a visual on it in a
it was podcast. Pages from Nancy, was it? Or
yeah, I would cut out frames and invite people and send them frames in the mail and say, okay, take this frame here, and it would be like Nancy eating a hot dog, and I take another random frame and it would be like sometimes it'd be another Nancy from a different comic, or sometimes it would be Popeye, or sometimes it'd be Garfield. Mm-hmm. So you have Nancy eating a hot dog, and then they have another random frame of Garfield sneezing. And then they have to make up a story between the two. So you lay them down. It actually would be really an inviting prospect. You'd start to think about it and you're like, oh, Nancy's eating a hot dog. And then she, you know, the hot dog makes her, it's a magic hot dog, and it makes her grow two heads, and the two headed Nancy creature goes and destroys all the cities and releases a germ warfare, and everybody's sneezing and dying. And that leaves a Garfield sneezing. And Garvin, you add a little balloon from Garfield saying, Nancy, I'll get you from this in the afterlife. So I would usually mail out like 10 frames so people would have a choice. And I did 4 issues of it. And I kind of stumbled on it by accident. And I managed people in the comics community tend to really support each other's projects. So I got new people, I got old people. It ended up being a really good way to reach out to other cartoonists. And like you said, we grew up on superhero comics, which are always a sort of assembly line process. So yeah, the cool thing, the hard part about a lot of illustration gigs is that it really becomes not fun immediately. You have people hanging over you and micromanaging you. And sometimes the magic just isn't there. You're like, why did I even like to draw in the first place? Once you're like really trying to get the ball rolling, a lot of times people just hate the illustration project by the time they're done with it. But this has been very much in the improvisational spirit of Suspect Device. And
I was thinking it was a similar process, you know, in some ways. Yeah. I mean, a couple pieces I showed you early on, Jason, was there was a famous one in Mad where Harvey Kurtzman would write and kind of lay out a story. Well, with this side of case, he did a pastiche of Bringing Up Father, which is a very well-drawn strip, you know, Sunday strip. Okay. So what he did was he had Will Elder, who drew these sequences that look exactly the style of McManus. And it was the parody of this strip where it was like Maggie and Jiggs, and Maggie would throw plates and stuff at Jiggs. And, you know, it's just like this cute, it's sort of a cute, you know, home domestic thing. But, you know, they amplified it. And so what Kurtzman did was he hired Bernard Krigstein, this like brilliant, you know, sequential artist, but he for this he just did this really German expressionist style, which kind of intrudes on this like perfect style. So there's this perfect cartoony style, and then all of a sudden there's this German impressionism, and it's really brutal, and it's you know, Maggie smashing poor Jigs with plates until he's like bruised and bloody. And it was like, holy shit. Like at the time it was like, wow, that's crazy. And two styles together. And later, the Marvel Comics secretary, Flo Steinberg, who's a lovely person. She edited an underground comic called Big Apple Comics. And she got Neil Adams is like a big art star. So he did this story where he split it down, split the pages down the middle. He did the sort of pornographic story on the left side of every page. And he got Larry Hama and Ralph Reese to do a similar, like, but much more degraded pornographic story on the right side. And Ralph's drawing style is just really awful. And like, you can see every little cockroach. So it was like, you know, this, you know, sort of pretty style on one side and the ugly style on the other. So we're not like, I don't think that that's really the distinction here. What we have now with this is a much more free flowing thing where I do the kind of a sort of image comics-y looking, you know, whacked out crypto religious story on the one side that's kind of shiny. And Josh is doing his much more classical, sort of classical allegorical style of some sort. But I'm not sure if that's going to continue with Josh. I'm not. The good thing about Josh is he's completely unpredictable. So whatever he wants to do is fine by me, and we'll work it out. You know? So we'll see what happens. It's happening as we're doing it. It's kind of, you know, I have sort of this rough sort of Jacob and the Angel storyline with this like angel that turns into a six-armed warrior goddess, comes down and smashes this tower, like famous Chicago Tower, which is already falling apart and held in stasis. And this poor hapless punk fuck comes in and just is tried, somehow gets inveigled into this drama. So I got the drama sort of figured out. I know where I want to get to. And then Josh's help and the googly-eyed God's will, and we'll see.
Josh, can you talk a little bit about, I mean, you know, James referred to you as a punk artist. What does that mean, and how did punk influence your art, or how does it continue to influence your art?
I mean, punk was like a big survival network for me when I was growing up, an emotional survival network. It really helped me forge my earliest sense of identity. I feel like it's been a process. I think a lot of the artists that I like in punk, like people who had a political bent, like who did like angry, like you know, cartoons that kind of served a social function, like that aided like activist movements. A lot of the WPA cartoons were very like proto-punk, and a lot of that language I think carried on into zines, where it's very much about saying something that's direct, saying something that's angry, really appealed to me. There's kind of a weird process of trying to make that authentic. I think a lot of kids have probably had the experience where they have something they want to say, and they try to make a polemic, and kind of the magic goes out of it because they get so into having a idea or kind of like a manifesto they want to get down, or they want their work to be a little bit aggressive or a little bit really spell out really vicious, hard-edged ideas. Like Pettibone was good at that. You read a Pettibone piece and you're like, you know, this guy is able to have this poetry running alongside these images. And there's always, whenever you read an early Pettibone image, it's always a little bit wicked and a little bit funny, like a, you know, punchline of a song. And then if you have that hanging over you, it can be really hard to make your work like really match the ambition the ambition of like making it really feel punk. So a long way of saying, it's really nice to hear people consider my work to be punk in any way. Slowly, like learning how to do the language of comics, you get more and more comfortable being able to kind of say almost anything that you want. But in the early days, you're lucky. You're very, like, it used to be with me when I would try to make work, it would come out really ugly. Like a lot of the beauty would go out of it the more I had like a overt idea I wanted to get across, almost like the need to make it into a preconceived shape would really corrupt it. Slowly, that's gone away. And that's, I think, one of the reasons I connect with students is because I talk about that a lot. I talk about how many weird divisions there are in kind of building your identity as an artist. Anyways, really identified with punk growing up. I had a copy of Naked Raygun's Treason album way back when I first discovered all the other bands that I loved. Always liked the fact that they had graphics that were rooted in sci-fi and punk and narrative, you know, that kind of road warrior looking figure on the cover of it.
I mean, I would say that with the, you know, the song, I you know, the lyrics of the song gave me, like, the energy of the song feels like it could have been done now. It could have been done in the 80s. To me, it's like it feels like a timeless. I mean, I still think the punk ethic kind of is still completely freaking relevant. If anything, the world's gotten worse. So it's just a reaction to the horror and chaos of contemporary life. And, you know, so, you know, it isn't invalidated because it's like a little older. It was always the valid. It was always the only sane response to my mind. But, you know, so like the energy, I mean, I like to go like, you know, the guy goes, oh, close my eyes for 10 seconds and hope it goes away. Well, it doesn't. So that's what we're drawing, I think. Right. It's like, this isn't going to go away. And we, you know, we're in the position where we can draw things, you know, draw whatever we want. So we can get some huge scale to what we're doing with very little budget. So that's the advantage of comics. You know?
Well, let's talk about the drawings.
This is a tiny little comic, though. 7x7 is tiny. So it's hard to even work. I keep wanting to work bigger, and then I work bigger. It's like the drawing for the disc is humongous.
Well, I was going to show my arms. We're making, you know, this is my. I've made lots of records. This back in the 90s, I ran Rocco Records in Chicago. Chicago punk label, putting out, you know, Midwestern punk bands. But I've never done an etched record, which is you know, to create a non-playable side of the vinyl that contains only artwork. And so this is for a 7-inch record. And so James did drawing for the etching. And how big, James said, oh, it's got to.
But that was like, yeah, it was like
a little bigger. And then when I showed up at
4 feet square,
I rolled this giant, giant thing.
It's a huge thing. But, you know, I couldn't figure out what I was even doing, because that was the beginning of the improvisational process. I just started drawing, and I was like, you know, I can't get, I did some smaller ones, and I was like, I can't draw what I want to draw this small. So I had to go bigger because the things I was thinking of were big, you know, but you know, that I got enough of the idea into that one drawing to start to figure out what to do for the comic. The drawings I'm doing for the interior comic though are really light and very small. And then really in the inside comic, most of my work is actually in doing the color, and I've been coloring it digitally, but I've been putting a huge amount of effort into the color. So, and I rarely get the chance to work in color. A lot of times when I do color books, I work with Marguerite and she does the coloring, but you know, I like doing color. And in this case, I'm getting to do stuff I've never done before. So I really am fun with it. So, and it's all kind of spurred by the lyrics, but it's not really directly corresponding with that. It's really just more the energy. They have a very kind of a, I don't know, it's like a laconic and quite light hand on their stuff. It's not super special effects music, but somehow I'm doing this super special effects comic. So that's a strange, yeah. That's a strange thing. You know?
Well, hey, and here's a question. Both of you, for the most part, work using traditional mediums, you know, paper, pencil, ink. I want to ask you, why, which I know sounds like I'm putting you on the defense, like, why the fuck are you still using paper and pencil and ink? But I'm curious why, when everyone's gone heavily digital, you guys have stuck to that.
All those people gone heavily digital will have nothing to sell later on, because there's no object. You know, you need to have some drawings on paper, because people that like your work want that kind of stuff. And I like making things, you know, I mean, you're making things by hand. Yeah, I watch a lot of my students draw directly digital. I'm kind of like, wow, that's great. Except yeah. you're not going to have, you're not going to have any, you know, sketches, no, nothing. It's like you got no secondary market stuff. This is, that's all. I mean, it really comes down to practicality, but also those things have a beauty of their own. You'd freak out if you, I mean, I can't show it to you because it's a podcast, but you know, the point is I can tell you that the drawings, you would freak out, the little ones for the inside.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just rooted and I'm like a 20th century guy, and I'm rooted in, you know, all the cartoonists who came before me, and a lot of the mold, the mold I was kind of I looked at the people I admired. They tended to do stuff in black and white. They tended to do stuff in pencil and then ink, and then they print. I have, you know, James and I both color digitally, but yeah, the first stage is ink. But I also, you know, I tried to tell my students, the way comics look really forged because in reaction to print technology, you know, the lines were the lines that people made. The reason that they make feathering instead of using a gray wash is because wash is very hard to reproduce. Comics are being printed on these printing presses that were designed to print letters. And that's the same way that woodcuts and lithography formed. It had to do with what kind of ink, what kind of lines you could mass produce. So it's interesting to see the way the medium's changing, and you see people like you see people who their earliest work it might be pencil now and pencil and crayon, or it might be all red line instead of all black line. I think those things are very positive. And I tell people when I'm teaching them, they're like, "Why am I doing pencil and ink?" And I'm like, "Because I was molded in a very 20th century kind of template." We still both just work the way we work. James is right. It is really nice to have a physical object when you're done. And one of the things that really galvanized me in becoming the cartoonist that I want, really kind of making the transition like 20 years ago from trying to do kind of weird fine arty stuff to trying to really commit to the medium of comics, was seeing the 20th Century Cartoon Masters show, which was touring the US. And I saw original Harold Gray, original Chester Gould, and especially of all people, Harriman. I mean, I loved, I still think about other guys a lot, but I mean, I think about all those guys a lot as kind of like a North Star for how to navigate through my own work. It was really interesting to see the original work and to see how much of it was all involved carving. Like all those guys would use razors, but like usually for wind effects and gun blasts and motion lines, they'd almost do like a scratchboard technique where they would do ink and they'd scratch into it. And the guy who used it the most liberally was George Harriman and did Crazy Cat. So he would just, most of the other guys would use it because, like I said, there's a story reason. They need to have a rushing white line. But Harriman would just do it like a negative crosshatch. He would crosshatch something and then want to have the crosshatching get lighter. And he'd just carve it away. He'd sometimes have characters' bodies kind of dissolving as if there's an impressionistic effect where, you know, that looks like their legs are just out of focus or a wall was out of focus. And he would just carve like it was another nib. So the physicality and the way that you can cover up your mistakes and you can glue things on is a big part of my process. I do it, but I'll tell you, the razor effect has kind of gone out the window for me.
You know, the point is look, I'll still do color with watercolor a lot of times too, but I mean the point is I'm not afraid of, you know, using the digital things, but I think it's a thing when you actually make the mark, your impetus in creation of drawing and erasing and erasing and drawing and finding the shape of something. I guess there's a point where it is the same, similar in the computer, but I'm not ready to give up that part of my process, which is how I learned how to draw. Then I'm happy to put that, scan that puppy right into the computer and really then beat it to death in Photoshop. That's, you know, and this is a really perfect example, this particular comic, it has, you know, it's the best of both worlds. I get to draw and then beat the hell out of it in Photoshop. So, and I'm having a lot of fun doing that. So, I mean, you can do things in Photoshop that if you learned, like Josh and I did, how to do, you know, draw and color in the old school way, then when you have Photoshop, it's like, wow, you can do this, you can do this, and you can do this so much easier, you know? You can see the options, change the colors, do all these other things. But we have the knowledge actually of colors, actual color separation, to go in and know how to separate things out and how to, you know, we learned a different way. And I think it serves our purposes to do it the way we do it. So we're in both worlds. You know?
Just one last thing.
One of the things that's been fun for me is this, you know, project being kind of starting with the springboard of, we're going to do something based on this song, and that's just kind of a blank slate. So then, you know, you have this, you have to take it and run with it, but at the same time, there are also constraints of page size, of page count, of time. And so I just wanted to hear you talk, perhaps compare and contrast working within constraints versus, you know, kind of the open-ended nature of you conjuring up a project of your own and working on it until you decide it is done. And I guess the pros and cons of each.
Right. I'll start. I mean, every project's different. I mean, I'm working on my, like I said before, this has been a pretty fun collaboration. It doesn't really feel like work. So in a way it's really similar. it's like, you know, being approached about working on somebody else's project at this point would be something I'd have to consider really seriously, because you know, I'm already like working 24 hours a day on my own stuff if I'm on one sense or another. So I can squeeze in a project like this, it's actually pretty energizing, but it is yeah, like I said, I know how collaborations can be, where it's like it's being done by committee, and the other people don't communicate that well all the time, and a lot of all the other things go on when there's more than one person involved. So that can be a real drag, but this doesn't really have those elements. James gave me a lot of freedom. He's not giving me a bunch of notes about how to correct things afterwards.
It's sort of like your lead guitarist on my album or something.
Yes,
it is
the rhythm
section. How it feels.
There you go.
And you get a lot of solos.
So where can people keep up with your work, Josh?
They can follow me on Instagram at Josh M. Baer, B-A-Y-E-R, the aspirin. Ask me anything you want. I have a website, a web store on it. Buy some of my books. If you want to study with me, I'm I teach all over the place. I have a new class that's going to be starting up at Sequential Art Workshop. And all the links are on my various socials.
Excellent. And James, what about you?
Mainly I post most frequently on Instagram, and you can find me there. And then let's see, right now I got NFTs in Korea, yeah, South Korea, for the real collection. And I've got some other works at New Gallery in Paris right now. And my book Post York came out from Dark Horse last year, Burger Books and Dark Horse. And so, yeah, just keep working, keep doing stuff. And this is my most fun, exciting project I've had in ages. So here we go.
Very happy to hear that. And on that note, we need you to back this project. It's on Kickstarter right now. So go there and search for Naked Raygun, Broken Things, 7-inch, and comic book. And
don't hold James doing NFTs against us.
You know, it's like they forced me to do it. Like and if I hadn't done the animation on some of them, they were going to animate them. So it's like, well, I better animate them. So I did Jesus.
Wow.
You know, his heart comes out and explodes and covers him with blood. So there you go. I upended the idea of the NFT to be, a religious worship object for, psychopaths. There you go. Enjoy.
Nice. Okay, so the Naked Ray Gun, Broken Things, Etched 7-inch Record and Comic Book is live on Kickstarter. Go there and make a pledge, secure yourself a copy, as well as some incredible rewards, including original art from James and Josh, signed graphic novels from James and Josh, and even some vintage free shit from past Naked Ray Gun shows. James Romberger, Josh Bayer, thank you for joining us,
here. Thank you for doing this with us.
Thank you.
And you listening in, please make sure to subscribe, leave a rating, and follow us on the social media. We are simply Buy This Comic, all one word. Goodbye.